I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joseph Nye asks in his relatively new book, Is the American Century Over? He says many seem to think so, and he cites polls that show that in 15 of 22 countries surveyed, most respondents said that China either will replace or has already replaced the United States is the world's leading power. We're going to look at this issue this hour of the program, and Joseph Nye covers a lot of territory. I'm going to start with Syria because he mentioned Syria at the end of his book, and it's an important answer that he gives in an important situation that we're dealing with right now. He takes on different parts of the world to see whether or not they may achieve superpower status and looks at alliances too. What if Japan and China should become allies? What about India and China? What about Europe? What about Brazil? We'll look at all of those issues during the course of this hour. Joseph Nye is the University Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense. He is the author of many books, including Presidential Leadership and the Creation of the American Era, The Future of Power, The Power to Lead, and his latest book, which has been described as a long essay, is the American Century Over? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Joseph Nye, a pleasure to have you on the air. Hi.
Hi, nice to be with you today.
Yeah, very nice. We have a lot of things to cover. I would like to start with Syria, if you don't mind. Toward the end of your book, you said that we are having a real debate right now over intervention, how and in what way the U.S. should become involved in the internal affairs of other countries, considering that the president has authorized 50 troops on the ground in Syria for the first time. What do you make of that? Do you worry that if we don't do that, a terrorist group could establish, as you suggest, a safe haven like the Taliban did in Afghanistan?
Well, we do have to worry about the ISIS or Daesh, the Islamic State, whatever you use, whatever initials you use for it. And we don't want to give them the luxury of a safe haven. On the other hand, we learned the hard way in Iraq that you don't solve these problems by going in and trying to control the whole country. So I think the strategy that the president has been using of trying to use force plus local allies, particularly the Kurds in the region, have been effective, is the right strategy, but it's not not easily done. If you think of 50 American troops, they're really going to be advisors, not combat troops.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you keep the American role in that kind of a situation, then it's probably workable. I just don't think that large numbers of American combat troops can solve this problem.
Did you ever, and if so, at what point, imagine that we would be dealing with this kind of threat at this time in history?
Well, I think there was probably a collective failure of imagination of how bad things could get in the Middle East. But I think it's not a total surprise. I mean, the invasion of Iraq was a strategic mistake, which broke the framework of the state structure in the middle of the region and unloosed the Shia-Sunni religious rivalry, and now compounded with the social changes that were related to the Arab Spring, it means that we're going to see turmoil in this region for decades to come. This is a series of revolutions, and revolutions aren't over in a year or two.
Mm-hmm. All right, to the question, the main one in your book, is the American century over, which begs the question, when was the American century?
Well, I think, from my point of view, you start the American century with the end of World War II, when the United States becomes the dominant country in the global balance of power. Henry Luce, the famous publisher of Time Life magazines, proclaimed the American century in 1941. It was more of an aspiration than a reality, because at that time the United States was in fact going through an isolationist phase, and what Luce wanted us to do was to get involved in Europe in terms of fighting Hitler. Eventually we did, but when he proclaimed the American century in the spring of 1941, we weren't there yet. It was really at the end of 1945, after we had become the dominant country with the end of World War II, that I think you should really begin the American century. But it's since the 1940s.
It's interesting, as you describe in your book, that we seem to have thought of other potential rivals as becoming the next superpower. You remind us in the 1950s that everybody thought Russia may surpass the United States, and indeed had, when it came to a nuclear arms race, and looked like they may when it came to exploring outer space.
Well, that's right. When the Soviets launched Sputnik in 1957, there were widespread laments that the American period was over and the Soviets were going to be ahead of us. In fact, when Khrushchev came to visit the United States a few years later, he said, "We're going to bury you," meaning that the economy, the Soviet economy, was going to surpass ours. And at that time, it actually was growing more rapidly than ours. Of course, that wasn't what happened. We often overestimate our potential opponents, and this was just the first of many cases.
Mm-hmm. And later it was Japan, right, in the 90s?
Yes, in the 80s in particular, when the Japanese manufacturing was so effective, and many American industries, particularly the auto industry, were having trouble. We thought the Japanese were 10 feet tall. And today it's the Chinese. We look at the high rates of Chinese economic growth, and we think the Chinese are 10 feet tall. We have a long history of thinking we're in decline and exaggerating others.
Well, you spend quite a bit of time on China, and you talk about America outspending China militarily by 4-1. I didn't know it was that high, but in economic terms, things look more competitive. How so?
Well, China has had a very impressive past 30 years in terms of the rate of economic growth, and they have now gone to being the second largest economy in the world. They are a $10 trillion economy. We're a $17 trillion economy, roughly speaking. If you project the growth rates that the Chinese did have of 10% a year, and our growth rate's around 2% a year, then eventually they're going to be bigger than we are, with 1.3 billion people. But their growth rate is now slowed to 7% officially. But many people think that it's getting closer to 5 or 6% and will go down after that. Depending on which of those growth rates you project, you can either see China bigger than the United States in the early 20s, which I think is unlikely, or you can put it in the 2030 range if you think it's going to grow in the 7% range. But you think the growth is going to be more like 5%, 4-5%, then it's probably not until the 2040s, if then. So again, people tend to project current trends and exaggerate them and then act as though those straight lines that they project into the future are reality, when in fact they're not.
You talk about 2030 being the year when China will have more elderly dependents than children, and you say it will sap its vitality. Do you think that's one of the reasons that China decided to implement a two-child policy?
That's right. I mean, China's one-child policy had led to a situation where the Chinese labor force stopped growing a year ago, Chinese used to sometimes complain, "We're afraid that we're going to grow old before we grow rich." And I think the Chinese government realizes this. That's why they've relaxed the policy and now are allowing two children, though in practice, certain types of couples, for example, couples in which the children, they were single children in their youth, were already allowed two children. But I think the real reason the Chinese birth rate is going down is no longer because of the government restriction. It's been because of urbanization and education of women and the desire for smaller families. So it's not clear that China's population is suddenly going to jump as a result of this new policy change.
Hmm. They certainly have to clean up their air, don't they?
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, if when you go to Beijing, depending on which way the wind is blowing, quite literally, you can either see across the street or not.
Oh.
And it is very unhealthy. And I think they realize that they have, part of this rapid economic growth has been a rampant neglect for the environment. And they're beginning to realize that. And as they try to clean up the environment, this is going to add costs for them as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about soft power. You are the man who invented that term. You talk about what China has done to try to beef up some of its soft power. I didn't know they were doing this, setting up Confucius Institutes to teach its language and culture. Of course, the Olympics was an attempt and a soft power success that you write. What are countries and what is the United States doing to let the world, to use its soft power around the world? And is anybody else like China using it as effectively or more effectively?
Well, soft power is the ability to get what you want through attraction rather than coercion or payment. And most countries have some degree of soft power. The Chinese think that soft power comes from government propaganda or government broadcasting or setting up institutes like the Confucius Institutes to teach Chinese culture. The trouble is, in fact, a lot of a country's attractiveness comes from its society, not just from its government. So a lot of American soft power comes from our universities, from Hollywood, from the entertainment industry broadly, from foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and so forth. So we have a fair amount of soft power, the United States does, or attractiveness, because of our civil society. The problem that China has is that they want the Communist Party to control civil society. So it makes it hard for them to use the full resources of Chinese civil society. You get a very creative individual like Ai Weiwei, who is an enormously attractive cultural feature for China, and the Chinese put him in jail if he doesn't say the right things. And that's not the way to exercise soft power.
Let's spend some time before we invite phone calls on the decline of the Soviet Union, which we earlier said we thought maybe a superpower that could indeed surpass us back in the 1950s. The life expectancy you cite in your book is really quite low in Russia, and they have all kinds of health concerns, but they certainly have a president who wants to take over more and more territory. He seems determined to make Russia great again.
Well, Vladimir Putin is tactically quite adept. But strategically, he's not doing great things to Russians. If Russia is a country which is in demographic decline, which it is, there are going to be fewer and fewer Russians over time, and with major health problems, as you mentioned, and with a economy which is sort of a one-crop economy dependent on the export of oil and gas, two-thirds of their exports, they really need some serious reforms, and they need better relations with the West as a source of technology and ideas. In fact, Putin has gone the other direction. He's basically trying to turn his back on the West. His invasion of Ukraine and taking Crimea by force made him very popular at home because of nationalism, but it led to sanctions, which cut him off from some of the resources that he needs for innovation and change in the West. And I think he wants to replace this by an alliance with China, selling oil and gas to China. But there are limits to that as well. It doesn't bring him the kinds of new technologies that he needs. So I think Putin is taking a number of risks. And I think it's also true that when countries are in decline, they're more willing to take risks. In that sense, I think the decline of Russia is dangerous.
Hmm. You mention alliances in the book. What kinds of alliances, particularly when we look at China and Russia and Japan and India, what kinds of alliances and which would be most likely among those countries could create a greater superpower?
Well, I don't see any of them really going very far. Japan and China can't form an alliance because China wants to keep Japan in a subservient position. They oppose Japanese membership of the UN Security Council, for example. Russia and China, as I mentioned, can tactically coordinate at the UN in terms of opposition to the U.S., but a deep alliance like you saw between the two countries in the 1950s, very unlikely because neither of the two countries really trust each other. If you look at the prospects of an alliance between India and China, it's not likely because India and China have a border dispute and also a rivalry for which is going to be the most powerful country in Asia. So I don't see any of these alliances presenting a challenge to the U.S., and on the contrary, the most effective alliances are between the United States and Europe and between the United States and Japan. So on the business of alliances, I think the Americans have an edge there as well as in our own capacities.
Mm-hmm. India is going to surpass China in population by 2025?
Yes, India is growing very rapidly and in terms of population. And it's now its economy is now growing at about 7.5% a year, but the Indians have to do something about education and infrastructure, and particularly literacy of women. If you have a large increase in your population, but the people are not educated, they're not going to be as productive, and that increase in population becomes a liability rather than a resource or rather than an asset. So I think the big question for India is not just is its population going to increase so that it's going to be greater than China, but are they going to be able to get their literacy up? India's literacy overall is about 75%, for women about 65%. China, to its credit, has literacy rates up in the 95%
range. Hmm. Joseph Nye is our guest this hour. He is former dean of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and he asks in his recently published book, which is a long essay, is the American century over? He gives some historical answers to that question and looks at all the people in the countries we thought may surpass the United States as the world's superpower, Russia at one point, Japan at one point. Certainly we're thinking that China, some think it already has surpassed the United States. What kind of power can a superpower wield? What kind of alliances are needed? We'll talk about the U.S. and our alliances at this point in time and how they can be used for good. He also looks at the huge number of issues facing the whole world, infectious diseases, terrorism, global climate change, and how our alliances will need to be strong in order to take on many of those very important problems. Our phone number, we'd love to hear from you, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Joseph Nye is the University Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Harvard School of Government. He served as Secretary of Defense in the 70s. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Joseph Nye is with us this hour. Is the American century over is the question of the hour, and we go to your phone calls, starting with Carl in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. What an interesting discussion. I was just thinking, is the American century over? The question that maybe puts that in context is the global century over? We have a billion people on the move, displaced by a variety of crises around the world, and we have a climate that is fast outpacing our collective ability to do anything substantive in response to where we may be, even just a generation from now. So a critical question might be, instead of shouldering ourselves up against other countries and sort of seeing who comes out as top dog, is that way of thinking ultimately something that may put us all in peril?
Well, I think that's a very good point. And basically, I address that in the book, in which I say that there are some issues which are competitive issues, or you might call them zero-sum issues, but there are other issues which are games against nature, if you want, such as climate change or pandemics and so forth. And there, the only way to deal with them is through cooperation. And that's going to require us, at the same time that we may be competing with China in, let's say, the South China Sea, we're going to need to be cooperating with China and other countries on issues of climate change. So I think your question is correct, which is that it's not enough just to say, are you number one in traditional forms of power? You also have to ask, are you capable of attracting other countries to work with you to try to get things done on these transnational issues?
Anything else, Carl?
Yeah, I just think that I appreciate your comments, and I think that our economy is here as a guest of our environment, and if we don't have our environmental house in order, everything else is subsequent to, you know, the fruit of that. So I encourage the conversation, and at the same time thinking more broadly about how we fit, how my kids who are 17 and 20 will be at my age will depend a lot on how we shape these kinds of conversations, and our way of thinking about our future needs to include those kinds of fundamental questions. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Carl, very much for your great question. And in order to play a significant role on the world stage, we also need to come to some domestic agreement, don't we, on some of these issues like climate change, which we just don't seem to be able to do, Joseph.
Well, we have a backlash against the science of climate change that's been going on politically since the Great Recession of 2008. But I think we're beginning to see that changing again. I noticed a poll today that 60% of Americans agreed with Pope Francis that we had to do more about climate change. I suspect that the pendulum is going to swing back toward a greater realization that this is a serious issue.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the military for a moment. This figure just stayed in my mind that you cited, America outspending China militarily by roughly 4-1. Do we need to spend that much money?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are certain things in the defense budget that could be cut back if we were going for pure efficiency. But if you take the overall size of the military budget, and you also want America to be a global power, then much of that budget is being spent, I think, to good purpose. It's worth remembering that what we spend on the military today is a smaller percent of our gross domestic product than what we spent in the Cold War. At the height of the Cold War, we spent about 9 or 10% of our gross domestic product on the military. Today, it's more in the range of 4%. So it's not something that's been going up and up and up in percentage terms. And I think the questions of how you spend intelligently or effectively are very real questions about the military budget. But in terms, is the military budget breaking the country? Not in comparison to our own past.
Well, what questions do you have about where we may not be spending very effectively as Assistant Secretary of Defense? You served in that capacity. You must have thought about this.
Well, there are questions about whether you want to invest as much in manned aircraft, for example, or move more toward UAVs, unpiloted aircraft. There are also issues which have to be thought through about whether an extra aircraft carrier is as important as, let's say, extra ships that are lighter. These are hard questions. It's not as though there's an obvious answer to them, but they need careful analysis. So we shouldn't just put the defense budget on autopilot. We have to think through these things. And then there are also some inefficiencies of the way we procure weapon systems and cost overruns and so forth. So there are things that can be trimmed, but I don't think that the defense budget is way out of control in the way sometimes people describe it.
Mm. Did you think it was in the 50s, 9 to 10%?
I think in retrospect, perhaps we exaggerated the Soviet strength too much. We thought there was a missile gap in the 50s. When in fact there wasn't a missile gap. It was in our favor, not against us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we exaggerated Soviet strength. On the other hand, Stalin's Soviet Union did pose a serious threat to us, and we needed to balance Soviet power to preserve Europe from being overrun by the Soviets or overwhelmed by the Soviets in a political sense. And in that way, I think the money was it was appropriate to spend, but I think we might have gotten what we needed for less.
Mm-hmm. Maddie is our next caller in Waupaca. Hi, Maddie.
Hi. I heard on the news that recently, in the last couple of weeks, China bought two of our oil fields in Texas. That seems ridiculous to me that our country would allow that. Also, I feel like I guess we can thank Richard Nixon and the Republican Party that we have such a strong rival against us in the world.
Well, I think China would have recovered anyway. I don't think that, Nixon and Kissinger, by opening relations with China, basically were trying to balance Soviet power. And so in that sense, that helped China, but it also helped us in terms of countering Soviet power. Now, in terms of how we treat China or think about China, they're a rival for some purposes, but we also need to cooperate with them for other purposes. And trying to do both those things at the same time is always hard. It's, you know, the famous joke about walking and chewing gum at the same time. But we should be able to do that. That means there's some things you don't want to sell to China, high-tech items that will affect our military balance with China. But there are other things that, why not sell it to China as well as anybody? And that includes oil. I mean, China, the United States is, by the 2020s, is going to be probably a net exporter of oil. So it's not as though the shale revolution has basically made us a major oil producer. And the Chinese can't buy an oil field in Texas and take it home with them. So the question is, can they produce oil and ship it to China? And the answer to that is yes, and we'll make sure that they pay a good price for it. And then that helps our balance of payments. So there's some things we don't want to sell. There's some things we might as well sell because it's good economics. And I would think oil is in that category.
Thanks, Maddie, for the call. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're asking, and our guest has written a book on this with the answers. Is the American century over? Joseph Nye is our guest. He's University Distinguished Service Professor, former Dean of the Harvard School of Government. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense, and he's the author of many books. He looks at where America is in terms of influence and superpower status. Are there other countries that are destined to take the place of the United States? Does that make a difference to us, how we use our status, and what may be holding us back from using it in a more beneficial way? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Joseph Nye, let's look more domestically here. In order to be a country that has influence in the world, you have to be pretty strong at home. You talk about these cross-country comparisons on how well we do in math and in science, and also whether or not we remain a magnet for foreign talent and could be stronger if we've figured out our immigration policy. Let's take both of those on, starting with the first, that we're just kind of behind in math and science. What does that do to our status in the world?
Well, it would be better if American high school students and grammar school students scored better on these international tests on math and science. That would put us in a stronger position overall. On the other hand, we do at the university level have the world's leading position in math and science. But it's also true that a good deal of our international position in this area rests on the fact that we're open to the rest of the world. Many of our good graduate students are from overseas, and I think that's been very good for us. Many of those students stay on afterwards and are very productive members of our society. For example, I saw some numbers that something like a third to a half are Silicon Valley startups, which has been a dynamic area of the American economy, were by immigrants from Asia, many of them people who came here first as students, then stayed on, got a green card, and started companies, and that's provided jobs for other Americans.
And what about immigration? We're having a heck of a time getting that one figured out.
Well, immigration is a long-standing problem for the United States. We've always complained about it, but we basically are a country of immigrants. In the 19th century, you had a political party which was formed basically against Irish immigrants. It was called the Know Nothing Party,
mm-hmm.
And it was bitterly opposed to the inferior type of immigrants that were coming from Ireland. Of course, within a century, we had an Irish president, John F. Kennedy, and we go through this. Every generation seems to oppose the generation of immigrants that comes after it, but in fact, those immigrants are one of the things that make the country strong. So we complain about immigration, but in fact, it's been a tremendous source of strength. In fact, we are the only rich country, the only developed country, which is going to preserve its ranking in the world in terms of population in the middle of this century. We are now number three after China and India. By 2050, it's going to be India, China, but the U.S. will still be number three. And the reason is because of immigration, whereas Europe and Japan and Russia are all going to be declining.
Hmm. Let's go to Mike in Portage next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I want to go back to a previous caller, Carl, who suggested that maybe the global century is over. You project growth for various countries, and the world is starting to look fairly finite. And so it's hard to say exactly how high we can take it. But do you make any account for a finite world in your growth projections?
Well, on the input side in the economy, in other words, is there enough iron ore, is there enough copper ore, the answer is I think there's plenty. I mean, what we found in the past, whenever we thought we were going to run out of a raw material, technology and technological change would make it plentiful again. For example, we thought we were becoming increasingly dependent on imported oil and gas, and then the technologies of horizontal drilling and horizontal fracturing meant that we've become less and less dependent on imported energy. So it's not the input side that worries me. It's what I might call the output side. If you find this extra oil and gas and you burn it, what do you do with the carbon dioxide afterwards? And that's the one that we haven't come to terms with. So I don't think we're running out of inputs in terms of raw materials, but I do wonder whether we know how to deal with the outputs in terms of the CO2 and other greenhouse gases that are producing climate change. And
that's another whole story in terms of whether the global century is over. I was just looking at the inputs and their restriction on growth and water and capital. I still don't see any, I think those two are going to be short.
Well, I think you're right about that. There are parts of the world where there's going to be considerable shortages of water. I think that, and that is a real problem. I don't think and there are parts of North America that suffer, but I don't think that we as a continent are going to have the same kinds of problems that, let's say, Africa or the Middle East will have. On capital, I think we should be able to generate capital. Obviously, capital comes when you have savings, and those savings we turned into capital for investment. I'm less worried about the shortage of capital than I am about the as an input than I am about the point I made of CO2 as an output.
Thanks, Mike, very much for your call. We go to Tony in Madison. Hi, Tony.
Hello. I really enjoy this conversation, and I was going to try to make a fancy question. I don't have that much education, so I'm going to go really to the point, and I do have a follow-up. Does the world look at us different now that we've put a alternative lifestyle very high up in the Army?
That's a good question, and we should be able to answer it eventually with public opinion polls and other things. But my impression is the change to we used to have don't ask, don't tell, which meant that we had to fire many talented military people who were homosexual, gay and lesbian. I think the fact that we're not doing that anymore hasn't reduced the efficiency of our Army. I think what people will be more interested in seeing is how the Army performs. I haven't seen any polling data that shows that there's a lack or drop in respect. But in the long run, the respect for the military will be how it performs as a fighting force, and I think that will be more important than the lifestyle per se.
The follow-up on that would then be the where you say Russia doesn't particularly want anything more to do with the West, because some people would say the moral compass has changed, and then the strength of that moral compass could be then the crumble of that.
Well, yes, except I mean the Russians are going through a period where Putin is using the church, the Orthodox Church, and conservative values to develop an increased nationalism and an anti-Westernism, which is related not just to the United States but to Europe as well. And this is working for him up to a point. His popularity is now very high. His polls around 80% or 90%. But I'm not sure that this is going to last for a long time. In other words, at some point, if he doesn't get the economy back on track, if he doesn't start making the reforms that are necessary, these types of diversions that he's using relating to nationalism and cultural issues are not going to be sufficient to keep his support that high.
Tony, thanks very much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. We're asking the question this hour, is the American century over? Joseph Nye is our guest, University Distinguished Service Professor and former Dean of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. It's the question that he asks in his book that is a lengthy essay, and we're discussing all that's involved in the book this hour of the show. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join this conversation and answer the question yourself or ask our guest questions about his question. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joseph Nye is our guest this hour. Our number is 800-486-8655. I want to ask you a question about influence, Joseph, because I'm not sure exactly what that means. You talk about the fact that that we influence matters more than military might, more than domination. How do we influence other countries, and in what ways do we now influence other countries?
Well, we influence them by three different major ways. One is our military. Another is our economic strength. And the third is our culture and values, which produce the soft power we talked about earlier. So our influence or our ability to get others to do the things we want really comes from all three of those sources.
Let's go to more phone calls. James in Oak Creek. Hi.
Hi. I just kind of wanted to add that I think in a way the American century is kind of coming to an end. I mean, we have this political infighting, this political stalemate. It's been kind of on and off for, you know, most of the Obama administration and arguably throughout, the last couple of years of George W. But we're also falling behind in STEM, science. Technology, engineering, mathematics, if you look at the statistics. And, we have, I think the only thing we really lead in the world in right now is military spending. And don't get me wrong, I'm not against that. I'm actually a veteran myself. I'm actually sitting in the Blocky VA parking lot in Milwaukee talking to you. But, I think we've definitely hurt our image in the world with the ongoing war on terror. With the way that we've responded to it, and then kind of, like I said, the political infighting, you have Benghazi, which, say what you will want that about that, but you have Libya, Syria, in a way we seem like the rest of the world. And this is actually from some of my friends in the, the German army, the British army, that we seem like we're not united anymore in the country. There's just kind of, I don't know, disjointed dichotomy that people see when they look at us. We're arguing a little bit too much. It's people like Donald Trump and Ben Carson and people coming up. I don't know. I guess I'm kind of rambling a little bit here, but I think in a way that it is kind of coming to an end. At least our exceptionalism. I think we've held on to American exceptionalism for a little bit too long. And I think if we want to be seen as a leader in the global, on a global stage, I think we need to start acting a little bit more as though we're part of the community rather than an exception.
Joseph Nye.
Well, I agree with that last point about we need to work with others if we're going to have soft power and if we're going to attract others to work with us to deal with some of these items. But I don't think it means we're coming to an end. On American Science and Technology, when a Chinese university did a survey of the top 20 universities in the world, 15 of the 20 were American, and none of them was Chinese. And we definitely need to do better with science and technology training at the secondary school level, but it doesn't mean that we're not at the forefront of the new technologies like nanotechnology or biotechnology or the next generation of information technology, where in general people see the United States as at the forefront. So I think the point that your listener makes about we need to work with others if we're going to get some of the things done relating to climate change or pandemics or counterterrorism or dealing with cyber issues and so forth, I agree with all that. But I don't think that what we're seeing with our constant bickering in politics in Washington is the end of the American era. We've had some pretty tough times in the past. You know, thinking of Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy.
Sure.
The bitterness of that in the 1950s, when even a strong president like Dwight Eisenhower couldn't control him. You know, we've been through some of these things before, but I do think right, your listener's correct about the need to learn how to cooperate with others better.
Mm. Julie on Facebook asks this, Professor Nye, what keeps the U.S. a world superpower? What about the U.S. dollar being a reserve currency and the fact so much oil is being traded in other than U.S. dollars, Russia, Africa, China, India, Europe, Brazil?
Well, most people that I know as economists who look carefully at this think the U.S. dollar is going to remain the most important reserve currency for well into the next decade or more. And part of that's because we have deep and rich capital markets, which are liquid. You can get your money out when you want. And also because we have a rule of law. If there's a dispute, you go to a court and get a fair settlement. That's not true for China. And so while China is making an effort to see whether they can clear more trade in their what's called renminbi or yuan, it's not about to replace the dollar.
And we go to Brett in Oconto. Brett, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was calling. I recently read that one of the things that the Putin circle is kind of paranoid about fostering anti-Americanism with is this idea that America is going to try to seize Siberia. I'd recall reading many years ago during the early years of Putin's first presidential term that there was concern that China would seize Siberia with the border being right there and a large population next to a fairly empty zone. And now with global warming making Siberia more accessible, is Siberia going to become a battleground in the middle 21st century?
I don't think so. I was talking with a Russian friend recently, and the Russians are still worried about China and Siberia. The Russians have a lot of empty real estate. The Chinese have a lot of extra people. But the idea that the Americans are going to see Siberia may be good for Russian propaganda, but I don't think many people take it seriously in Russia or elsewhere.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Brett, for the call. Thank you so much, Professor Joseph Nye. And just finally, in about 45 seconds, the time that we're in now, in this part of this century, is reminiscent to you of any other time?
Well, I think it's hard to see an exact analogy. I think it's better than some other times. I think we're better off than we were in the 1920s or 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And in some directions, we're better off than we were in the 1950s. So I think this period is it's a period where there's some turmoil, but for people say that it's a lot worse. Well, never forget that in 1956, President Eisenhower couldn't prevent the Soviets from invading Hungary or the British and French and Israelis from invading Egypt. So we've had some hard times in the past, not to mention Vietnam. We'll probably have some more hard times in the future, but I still think, in the words of my book, that the American century isn't over.
Thank you so much for being with us. Our guest this hour, Professor Joseph Nye, and his book is The American Century Over, University Distinguished Service Professor, former Dean of the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, Chair of the National Intelligence Council, and Deputy Undersecretary of State for Security Assistance, Science, and Technology. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and stay with us as we talk about diversity and politics with Clarence Page. He'll be with us in just a little while.
Question. I don't have that much education, so I'm going to go really to the point, and I do have a follow-up. Does the world look at us different now that